This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Thanks so much for being here. Sorry I had to miss last week, except for Thursday, Friday, but I was back in action. And I'm glad because there's so much going on today. Fresh off the FIFA club final yesterday, which is pretty amazing at MetLife. Getting ready for the World Cup. Even if you're not a soccer fan, just get prepared. It is going to dominate your summer. Dr. Mehmet Oz is going to be in the bottom of the hour. He's going to be talking about the truth behind the big, beautiful bill as Medicare. He's got to get the truth out. That's his job. Medicare and Medicaid services. Lawrence Jones is standing by, and of course, there's going to be big announcements throughout the day. We'll get to Lawrence in a second, but let's get to the big three.
Number three.
So this whole idea that there's going to be a schism in MAGA, it's like it's the ongoing fever dream of the left, that there's going to be a schism. The idea that the Epstein thing is going to create a schism in MAGA is a little bit rich.
Well, Mark Thiessen, perhaps. MAGA versus MAGA meltdown over the Epstein file soap opera reaches new heights. Will Dan Bongino resign? Will Kash Patel follow him out the door? If he does, is Pam Bondi's job safe? Why it all matters for the base, we'll discuss.
Number two.
But I am very disappointed with President Putin. And I thought he was somebody that meant what he said. And he'll talk so beautifully and then he'll bomb people at night. We don't like that.
Major announcement on U.S. policy towards Russia as the president seems to have reached his threshold for being lied to by Putin. Why I think simply adopting the Senate's bipartisan sanctions could result in this finest foreign policy hour.
Number one.
Because, you know, you have people who don't want to leave their homes, who are not going to work, and they are in need of cash. We're organizing food deliveries.
Oh, my goodness. What is wrong with Mayor Karen Bass? Where do I begin? Left, melting down over ICE as one judge looks to limit their West Coast action. We have all aspects of the immigration fight, including one of the one of Tom Holman's almost physical fight that he got in at Charlie Kirk's event over the weekend. So, Lawrence, you looked at, first off, great to see you again.
Good to see you.
It's
too,
been
bro.
Six
congratulations
minutes.
Congratulations on being number three in radio.
Oh,
I saw
thanks,
that
man.
Ranking came out. Yeah. That's pretty big.
Yeah, thanks. That is very nice of Talkers Magazine to rank us up there. Sean, Dave Ramsey, and then us. So it's great. It's a lot of fun doing this job. But, Lawrence, just on the court case that came down last week, you looked at it already.
Yeah.
And I don't understand. Let me just tell you from the pedestrian point of view. The judge concluded that ICE was moving just on people's looks and their accents.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. It's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. I'm thinking to myself, nobody thinks that.
No. I mean, the whole argument was ridiculous. What they're saying is that it was a Fourth Amendment violation, which means that it was a legal search and seizure. So they're saying that they were racial profiling. There's no evidence to suggest that. By the way, when you look at the people that they grab, criminal backgrounds, you got people that are here illegally in the country, and not to mention, which is what I talked about on Fox and Friends this morning, I understand there's a push to legalize weed, but federally it's still illegal. That alone, they could have moved in on that facility. So I don't think it has any merit. I think that the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals is going to eventually turn this over.
So what Tom Holman said, he said, I was taken out of context. He said, what I'm saying is if I see something physical like a tattoo,
which
MS-13 TDA, which they have, and you know, some of the Bulls stuff, the paraphernalia,
right.
that's technically, hey, you're wearing a Bulls uniform
cause.
From the 90s.
Right.
And that's really what
these... the thing that people misinterpret is it is a legal to profile someone solely based on one factor, so race, religion, or whatever. But race, religion, tattoos, whatever, can be included in a criminal profile. So you can't have one of them singularly be the focus there. But if I see someone that have the markings of TDA, and I've had a source inside of there saying, hey, there's some criminal activity, that's enough to move on that site.
So Fox is told that today the U.S. government plans to request a stay on the temporary restraining order granted on Friday. So I was pretty amazed over the weekend that every Sunday show except Shannon, no, Shannon brought it up too, was talking about this move on the marijuana plant, this glass house plant. And they're just talking about, well, look at the violence, because these people are farm workers. They just want to make a living, even though they're here illegally. Well, number one, they had to be tipped off because of the rocks and the number of people at the farm on the entrance and the exit. Number two, no one's bringing up the 300 people plus arrested, the rape, five rapists, abduction, one's child molestation, and they got 14 kids.
That's the story, Brian, the kids. I mean, this is not just, this is not people that are picking apples or your agriculture. These are people that are producing for a marijuana farm. And then the story that they continue still today, it wasn't just the Sunday shows, which you and I watched yesterday. No mention of the kids. And now 9 of the 14, I think, were unaccompanied minors. So we've been doing all this reporting on Fox about where are the kids? Is anyone going to find the kids? And then lo and behold, we find 9 kids that are working on the farm. So it begs the question to me. Now, I thought that some of them were involved in sex trafficking, but could some of the kids not be really missing? They're employing them illegally in the country right now?
Well, do you know the system? Because you've been to the border more than me. Do you know the system? You come across the border, you're an unaccompanied minor, right? But you have a sponsor. The sponsor has a phone. We have a phone number? That's good enough. Good. Goodbye.
That's right. That's
well,
right.
A lot of those sponsors are employers. Right. They're just going to put you against
or
your
traffickers
will.
Or anything.
They're not
yeah.
your relative.
No.
Do you know that they changed the policies at the border the day Trump took over? And you have to proof of ID. You have to have citizenship. Not right. just a passport. American
right.
citizenship. You had two forms of ID. And then you got to tell us what exactly you're going to be doing. You got to tell me what you do for a living.
That's exactly
that's
right.
That's what a sponsor does.
Brian, a lot of the times, and this is underreported, these kids, they come across the border. They've been raped. They've been already trafficked. The girls are pumped up with birth control. Some of them come across the border pregnant because someone has raped them along the way. You know, a lot of people used to talk about the policy of separating the kids and the parents. A lot of those weren't the parents. A lot of those were the offenders. That's why the Trump administration were separating the kids and the adults.
You know, before you were hosting the show, I was down at the border when Trump might have still been president last year. And they told me that the DNA kits... that they didn't have enough, but he goes, you know what they're doing?
Yeah.
They just pretend.
That's right.
So as soon as you pretend to dip the swab in to get the person's cheek, they go, okay, it's not my kid.
Right.
So they realize they're about to fail the DNA test.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, honestly, we shouldn't be surprised. This is a criminal enterprise. The getting the kids across the border and the drugs is only one portion of it. The other part is trafficking the kids. And now we see they're in the workplace as well.
So I want you to hear what Senator Alex Padilla, the new celebrity, they got wrestled to the ground because he would start screaming at Kristi Noem from 4 feet away. Meanwhile, she had to wait is to wait after the press conference, could have had the one-on-one. Here's what he said about the rhetoric and the violence. Cut 8.
Are you worried that heated rhetoric around this and around the policies are actually putting law enforcement agents at risk?
First, let me just denounce any violence against law enforcement is unacceptable. Do I think heated rhetoric is, you know, part of what's causing this response? Sadly, yes. And we've seen this administration escalate and escalate and escalate in all ways and matters, whether it's the tactics of with which they're going about immigration enforcement. There's a smarter, more effective way to do this.
Really? So it's the... It's the rhetoric, except for what?
I'm sorry. There is a more effective way to do this, and this is what the administration tried. They tried to work with the local police and the local courts, and the Democrats said no. They tried to capture these folks when they were already in jail or tried to partner with the police that know their communities, and you guys said no. So now they have to come in with a heavy hand, and you're in power. You're giving the locations away of where these ICE operations are happening. You're throwing rocks at them. There were gunshots against the ICE officers in California. So there was a more effective way to do this, but you guys chose not to go that route.
So to Dana Bash's credit, she does ask a follow-up. Cut 9.
They say that it's the Democrats' rhetoric, some calling ICE agents secret police, comparing them to the Gestapo.
Well, I wouldn't use those words, but I do have concern when there are no requirements for ICE agents or other federal agents involved with the immigration enforcement actions to not even identify themselves.
Can you pause that 1 second, Eric? Watch this. So when an ICE agent shows up, do you see the Kevlar?
100%.
Don't you see the names? Don't
and
you
the
see
badge.
The uniforms? And when they say just one, no, they come in numbers. So are you going to tell me that a fake militia is coming into farms?
This is such nonsense. first of all, federal agents as well as local cops, when they're dealing with drug operations, the vice units and all that,
they show.
You see their badges and everything, but a lot of times their faces are covered because the drug dealers and the cartels have made them a target. So whether you're talking about a local vice unit that are targeting drug operations or federally now, because now you're targeting them, they got bounties against them from the cartel. Citizens and activists are posting their photos and targeting their family. So of course they're going to cover their faces. But you can see their badges, their patches on them.
Yeah.
They're in uniform.
It's a joke.
It's such nonsense.
Yeah, let's just play the rest of that if we can.
Us, immigrant community, and you see unmarked cars roll into your community, people getting out of those cars with no identifiers that they are law enforcement, and literally not just detaining, in your mind, maybe kidnapping.
Kidnapping?
Kidnap, yeah.
I mean, at this point, right. You know, I appreciate her trying to be fair, but there's a point where you got to say, really, kidnapping? There's a federal warrant for these people. They're in the country illegally. There's no kidnapping. The process, the registry is in the federal agent's database. There's no kidnapping. It's rhetoric like that is why people feel like they're justified when they're throwing rocks and shooting at the cops.
But by the way, usually if it's kidnapping, it's like the hostage situation, right, to get money. What are they going to do? I want my neighbor out. Here's right. all my food stamps. you could take them all. Go get some cereal.
I'm just trying to figure out, when did a federal warrant, when people violated the law? And that's why we got to look at this. You got to take the immigration crime out of it. Coming in the country illegal, you just got to look at it crime for crime. If someone harbors or tries to prevent someone that they have a federal warrant or any type of warrant, you charge them with criminal conspiracy to conceal them, right? To obstruction of justice. But now we are allowing these activists to do this because it's an immigration issue, not a legal issue. If you want to change the immigration law, then come up with a proposal. Pitch it to the president. He loves making a deal, but they haven't done that. They just want to resist.
Right. And the president is talking about doing something for meatpackers, hospitality, and farmers in certain situations, even though a lot of his so-called base is very upset with that. We're going to be coming out a little bit more with Lawrence Jones. I want to get your take on what the president is going to announce today with Ukraine. Back in a moment, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So this whole idea that there's going to be a schism in MAGA, it's like it's the ongoing fever dream of the left. That there's going to be a schism. First it was Iran was going to create a schism in MAGA. Then the CBS poll came out and showed 96% of MAGA supporters supported the strike. So the idea that the Epstein thing is going to create a schism in MAGA is a little bit rich.
So what do you think, Lawrence Jones? That's Mark Thiessen yesterday on Fox News Sunday saying that the whole thing with Pam Bondi saying there is no list after saying there was a... She goes, I have files on my desk. Mm-hmm. And then them saying that he killed himself, Cash Patel, Dan Bongino, Pam Bondi killed himself. Something happening with Dan Bongino where he says, I'm not coming to work on Friday and I might quit. Mm-hmm. Me or Bondi. And Megyn Kelly said she had a source that confirmed that. So how does this play out? And why is it a big deal?
I remember watching I think it was Netflix, The Last Dance. And they were talking about the story of Michael Jordan and when he was on the Dream Team. And I remember one of the quotes from one of the players, because you got a team of all-stars. You know, they are the captains of the team. They're known, all that. They have their own fan base, yada, yada. And they said, in the room full of alphas, there was one alpha, and it was Michael Jordan. And I think that's what we're seeing play out in Trump world right now. You got a lot of big personalities. You got a lot of people that are used to being the leaders in their own perspective. But there's one president. And when a president makes a decision, that is the decision. I can tell you this. From my reporting, what I know for a fact, the president is 100% behind Pam Bondi right now.
There's no question. And he made it clear on two social. But the DOJ memo went out, not signed by anyone, that says the systematic review revealed no incriminating client list. There was also no credible evidence found that Epstein blackmailed prominent individuals as part of his actions. We did not uncover evidence that could predicate an investigation against uncharged third parties. No client list. Died by suicide.
I think, and this is what I can tell you from my sources. I don't think it's so much about the list where the infighting is coming from. It's the rollout of the list, right? Remember the social media people that they brought out and with the binders and everything. And when you look into it, there was nothing in the binders. And so I think some of the friction right now is that some people feel like there was going to be this big rollout of something when some of the people that actually read the documents at the time knew it wasn't going to be anything.
I think this is the clip with John Roberts that got everyone's hopes up. Cut 23.
The DOJ may be releasing the list of Jeffrey Epstein's clients? Will that really happen?
It's sitting on my desk right now to review. That's been a directive by President Trump.
And then she came back and said this last week, cut 24.
I was asked a question about the client list, and my response was, it's sitting on my desk to be reviewed, meaning the file along with the JFK, MLK files as well. That's what I meant by that.
And some people interpreted it that first initial interview with our John Roberts was that there was a list. She said it was a file. But again, I mean, the damage has been done in the sense of people were expecting something and it didn't necessarily happen. Now, we know for a fact because of our reporters in the interview that we did from the FBI is that there was nothing there. There was nothing there. That's what they told us on the record. They told us that that it was a suicide. And they're feeling that the Department of Justice kind of, you know, awakened or gave some credence to the beast. Now, the president, I think he's saying, hey, I'm going to make both sides sit down, knock it off. This is my administration. Get back to the mission of the American people.
But they have to come out with some type of statement because these people have a turning point over the weekend. Listen to Megyn Kelly.
Who have you seen? Pam Bondi. She has never missed an opportunity to go on television and dangle sweet nothings that might be coming your way. Try to lead you to believe that she's got it. It's on her desk. It's coming tomorrow. You're going to see something on Epstein. And it was a tease. So you either believe that Pam Bondi was telling the truth then or that she's telling the truth now. But both cannot be true. She was either lying when she went on Fox News all those times saying, I've got it. We're looking at it. Wait until you see it. It's horrible.
There's only one.
Or she's lying in her two-page memo that they released on a Sunday night at the tail end of a holiday weekend to Axios, as if Axios is where we all go for our news. Hell no. She went to someone she knew would not kick the tires on the story, and without signing the memo, dropped it in the dead of night and said, that's it. Take it. Take the crumbs and be happy. Make some noise if you care about the Jeffrey Epstein scandal.
Your thoughts. That's a young group. Under 30s, Republicans, conservatives.
Look, I can say some of my criticism on the micro level that I would have handled it this way. But I just think sometimes in MAGA world, I won't even say in MAGA world, I would say some of the influence, they get so caught up in the weeds of things. You got to realize who the enemy is and who the enemy is.
It's not Cash Patel and Dan Bongino.
It's not Cash Patel. Dan Bongino or Pam Bondi. They may have some disagreements on the rollout there, but we wanted a Department of Justice that was fair and wasn't weaponized. And they got to focus on that. Now, they're supposed to be rolling out some stuff that they found about the weaponization of the department. I want to hear that news. I'm not interested in this make-believe scandal.
Right. All right, Lawrence Jones, always great to have you on.
Brian.
See you tomorrow.
Congratulations.
This episode is brought to you by Avid Reader Press. Legendary investor Ray Dalio's new book, How Countries Go Broke, The Big Cycle, explains the mechanics behind big debt crises. Larry Summers says, Dalio's brilliant iconoclastic approach is an invaluable resource. And Hank Paulson says, it provides a solution to what is the biggest and most certain threat to our prosperity. Read it to understand the greatest economic issue of our time. Available now wherever books are sold.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, and it's my privilege to have in studio, first time in a long time, Dr. Mehmet Oz. But now he's got a new job, more important, doesn't pay as well, but he's not doing it for the money. Medicare and Medicaid Service Administrator, that's his new job. And, of course, this is the 60th anniversary of Medicaid, state fund medical program. meant for the elderly and the and would you say handicapped? Would you say the disabled?
Disabled. I call them the vulnerable. So young kids, 53% of kids are born into poverty, so they're on Medicaid or you know, there's CHIP, which is Children's Health Insurance. You've got the elderly folks who maybe worked their whole life, maybe not, but they've gotten to an age and they're out of money, so they need help. So Medicaid protects them. If they have some funds, then Medicare protects them. Both these programs were started 60 years ago this month. Both of them are the backbone of our social safety net programs, but it's a two-way street. You know, Medicare is there for you, but you need to stay vital and healthy as well as best you can. So taking precautionary steps, not eating carrot cake like I tempted you with. I bought you an apple too, by the way.
Right. If you've seen on the stream, you have a birthday cake for Medicaid.
I have a Medicaid cake.
Got it.
A Maha Medicaid cake.
Right. But always producing, right?
Always producing.
You got the TV and you got the medical.
Boom, boom. I'll be here all week. Try the corned beef. But the beauty of Medicaid and Medicare is that the government, perhaps one of the best examples of it all, is there is a safety net program to help you out. But it's a two-way street. And what happened recently, much of it during COVID, was we began to pervert the system. We began to cheat. So, for example, if the government, if federal government is paying most of the tab, the states began to hack the system so they could get extra money from government. They would pay for illegal immigrants, for example, in California, knowing that the taxpayers in Mississippi, they don't know any better. They're just paying to the federal tax bureau. And then that money gets recycled back to California to pay for illegal immigrants. We were paying for gender transition surgery. Right? Mutilation of children for allegedly helping them, which is not scientifically proven to be true, but that's money. But that money was partly coming out of the federal treasury. So again, people in Texas were paying for that, not knowing it. And so we decided we're going to be transparent. And when you learn more about these problems, you get upset about it. So the president said, we want to get rid of fraud, waste, and abuse. And they happen in multiple different areas. Fraud happens because if you don't know who's supposed to be on Medicaid and not, the same person can be in multiple states pretending they're living in those states. Each of those states get paid by the federal government, so the governors don't care. And that's $14 billion a year.
And that explains why it was so important to verify your eligibility twice a year. Correct.
That's why we believe it's a sane move. Not every month, not every 2 weeks, but every twice a year. Tell us what you're doing. It's also important because 60 years ago when Medicaid was created, it never dawned on anybody that you would be an able-bodied person and stay on Medicaid.
But is it a way to get universal health care? Didn't they talk about universal insurance? That's what Democrats have always wanted. But fundamentally, you're a doctor. You want to make sure that everyone gets an equal shot. But the best you can within our system that makes it sustainable, that keeps the smartest people as doctors and keeps our technology cutting edge. We still got to stay ahead of the curve. So it's tough to mix in capitalism and health. That's fundamentally your challenge, isn't it?
It's a shared responsibility.
Yes.
And shared responsibility works when all the stakeholders agree that we got to do something together to make the system work. I was handed an agency when President Trump nominated me that was in financial distress if you look into the
Absolutely.
Future. So Medicare, the trust funds predicted to go bankrupt. We just had this announcement 2 weeks ago in 2033. So we have 7 years left. Medicaid was going to draw down massive amounts of money from the Treasury, and it's not providing quality. The thing that people sort of gets to me when the Democrats complain about this is it's not like the system's working great for everybody right now. It's working good, but not great. So if you got number three cause of death being medical errors, we ought to get better at that. If we have patients having the exact same experience scheduling a doctor's appointment as they did 60 years ago when Medicaid and Medicare were created, that's the problem. We need to modernize the system. So this one big beautiful law, what it actually also does is give us $50 billion for infrastructure to rebuild the system so it's capable of being more efficient and dealing with and addressing some of the opportunities that the 2025 offers us.
So when this bill passes, you gave your advice on what to do, but then there's so many moving parts in this huge bill from defense on down. Medicaid is the big area where Senator Josh Hawley weighs in, says, don't touch it. My whole state of Missouri is financed by it, it seems. And then you have Chip Roy going, what are you guys not doing enough? How could the Senate not do more to cut this back? And then you have Democrats who don't say, well, I don't like the bill. They say, for example, Larry Summers says, 100,000 Americans will die because this bill passed. The most significant cut to social safety net in history. So, if you're just someone on the outside, go, I'm not going to read 980 pages. Literally, it's 980. What do I make of this? Where's the truth?
The president was very clear when he said he wants to love and cherish Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
Did not touch Medicare at all. And the Medicaid program, he said, take out the fraud, waste, and abuse. That's all we're doing. We're returning this system to the way it was before COVID, basically. There's all kinds of changes. I'll give you an example. Last year, under the Biden administration, they said that you could pay a doctor taking care of a Medicaid patient three times more than a Medicare patient's doctor. Now imagine this. Medicare patient, older gentleman, woman, worked their whole life, put money into the system their whole life. They come to the retirement age, they get their Medicare, and now the doctor's getting paid three times more to see somebody else. Well, guess what happens? All of a sudden, you're at the end of the line. And that Medicaid patient, who's an able-bodied individual who hasn't worked for whatever reason, never was pushed to work, is trapped in this place that they're living in, where they're generally watching television, 6.1 hours of TV or leisure time a day. They're not really, because they're bored. And their lives are not going anywhere. So we're enabling that behavior. They get to pay their doctor more. Now, that's not right. What did the states do? They immediately began to recruit as many able-bodied people on the Medicaid as possible. And then they would collect massive amounts of money. I mean, I'm talking about more than $100 billion a year of money. We said, guys, that's not the system. That was not how it was created. The founders of Medicaid, who were Democrats, Lyndon Johnson was a Democrat. Patient number one was Truman, a Democrat. They never envisioned that it would work for able-bodied people. In fact, every Democratic president, including Bill Clinton, who did the welfare reform, which brought work requirements into these programs, worked. Dramatically increased the number of people in the workforce, increased the people on these programs who got out of poverty because they decided to work. Look, you have agency over your future.
And also, people that were scamming the system said, well, I might as well just get a job, because I can't sit back and just lay back. So instead of you telling me to go volunteer somewhere, I'll go get a job.
Yeah,
and so we cut down the number of people on welfare.
And it's not even a work requirement. It's a community engagement. Go get an education. Go volunteer somewhere.
Do you guys help them get something?
We want to do all that. Brilliant question. We don't just want to figure out what you're doing. By the way, 91% of people on Medicaid have smartphones. And what we're doing already in two states is pilots to show you on your phone, tell us where you're working, and we will calculate how many hours. Well, no, because it's those payroll providers work for these companies, and we get the people in the gig economy as well, Uber drivers, we count them all, whatever you've done. The point's not to hurt you, it's to nudge you forward, to urge you to do the things you should be wanting to do for yourself anyway.
So let's say you know, you're making $50,000 a year, but if you live in a place like New York, you're having trouble even making the rent, you have to decide what's going to happen. Well, if I'm in my 20s, you know, stats say I'm not going to get insurance. Nothing's going to happen to me, you know, so maybe insurance is maybe the last thing you get. So what do you say to people who said, okay, now I'm not eligible for this new Medicaid because you expanded under Joe Biden, you expanded under Obama, really, and then you expanded even more under Biden, and all of a sudden I find out I don't qualify. Where do I go?
Well,
to the exchanges?
The exchanges are an obvious place to go. Let me give you a real-world example of what happened. 18 months ago, under duress, the Biden administration realized they had to course correct. And they had 15 million people come off the Medicaid rolls. 15 million people. No one talks about this. But the Democrats realized that this is really a crisis. Of those 15 million people who came off Medicaid, 10% became uninsured. 90% of people found a way to getting health coverage because they were eligible for it and took a lot of the fraud away as well. This is the real unwritten story of all this. If you can game the system, you might, but a little bit of a push in the right direction. And people, look, I trust the American people. I have confidence in the American people to take a deal like free health insurance for trying to get a job or getting an education. That's a pretty good trade-off. If you're not willing to take that deal, there's something else going on. Democrats argue because they don't have confidence in the American people, no one's going to take that deal. They're going to want to sit down and watch more television. They're not going to get forced out of their home because you're saying you're going to take away their insurance. This is how you keep healthy programs like Medicare, Medicaid alive for 60 years. Go to Europe and see what's going on there, where they have generational poverty because they've trapped people in a program where no one you ever met, no one you're related to has ever had a job. That's not what America's ever been about. If you can work, you should. If we can connect you to a job, to your earlier question, we're going to try to do that. Programs like that exist, but there's no reason for you to check if there's a job available if no one's pushing you to get out of your basement.
Have you been able to exhale enough instead of do the emergency situation with Medicare Fix It, Medicare and Medicaid Fix It, to take a deep breath and even think tank it, this is my word, with like, what is the big answer here? Because nobody wants someone without insurance. Nobody wants, fundamentally, nobody says, well, because you don't have money or you have... Doesn't matter. I don't care what state you live in. We all have the same objective. Give people the best health care possible. How do you not hurt the system and make it financially workable? What is the greatest burden on our budget? it's this, Medicare and Medi-Cal. So have you guys ever had big picture talk about revamping the system? I mean, Mark Cuban talks about this stuff all the time.
Yes, and I've spoken to him, by the way, as well, Mark, but many others, my whole adult life. I went to business school at Wharton because I wanted to know how to organize large groups, but also fix systems like this. The basic problem is that productivity in healthcare is 40% of the general economy. It's not an efficient system. Now, part of it's never going to be efficient. You're taking care of people with lots of problems. But we never really brought technology into the services part. If you go to a doctor's office right now, you got to write your name, your address, all your information.
I know, it takes forever.
But it's also a wasted effort because often it's not done correctly. The biggest problem we're having with changing prior authorization, where we got all the insurance companies to come together and voluntarily agree, put some pressure from us, to go out there and get rid of one of the most painful complaint about problems where you're trying to get care for your doctor and says, insurance company getting in the way. They're saying doctors don't talk to us using technology. They send us paper files. We have got to modernize American medicine. It is the ultimate solution for a lot of reasons. First of all, because it's more efficient, you'll cut at least 10, 12, 15% of the healthcare budget that you don't need to waste on paperwork and need this redundancy. Second, you'll get doctors with decision support. They'll be able to get advice about how to better care for you so they won't make mistakes. You'll help patients by communicating with them frequently about what's going on in their life based on their medical record. You can opt out, by the way, but if a patient wants to know about themselves, we'll tell you. But here's the part that's great. We have a massive target on our back. Foreign countries are attacking us. Last year, I announced with the DOJ and FBI and OIG that we have the largest ever shutdown of a $15 billion scam. I mean, people...
Which was what?
So the Russians, we believe, Russian mafia, not believe, we know this. We went after and arrested whoever couldn't get back to Russia, we arrested. When I say we, the DOJ, FBI, the government, the law enforcement of the government realized with us, because CMS, we have a bunch of really smart guys. We have a whole war room that goes out there with a bunch of, just so you can imagine, a room packed with whizzes with, out there on their computers, finding people trying to hack our system. So we are almost a $2 trillion agency. So people want to get into our bank. Our piggy bank gets raided not just by politicians, but it gets raided by foreign governments trying to steal money from us. They steal Medicare and Medicaid numbers. They use them to pretend they're in the system. Then they start to make these false claims. Now, here's the good news. Of the $15 billion that we shut down, only $2.9 got out the door. Once it's out the door, it's back in Moscow. It's overseas in the Cayman Islands, right? So you have to stop it from leaving America. But we stopped $12 billion, and we're getting better.
When was this?
A week and a half ago.
Wow, that's awesome. Did Doge help?
Doge helped a lot. Doge is, people criticize Doge for many unfair reasons, but there's no question that Doge has been effective at getting people to stand up straight in their chair and do their homework. They're tech whizzes, so they come into the system. They're the ones who identified we have $14 billion stolen from Medicaid because people claim that they're on Medicaid in multiple states or Medicaid and the ACA exchange, Obamacare in the same state.
So they identified, did they fix it? Wait, it's up to you to fix it.
It's up to me to fix it. What they're good at is catalyzing awareness. It's up to me to fix those problems. But the beautiful thing about being in this administration, it is the best job I've ever had. And I've had your job. I've been in media. I've been in the OR as a surgeon. But I've got a great boss. President Trump is engaged. He'll call you up. He'll hear this interview and make some comments about what I've said right or wrong. But he also gives you a vision for what we need to do. And time is not our ally. The more we sit around doing nothing, the more people make up reasons to stop us. We want to stay one step ahead of people who are trying to slow the process.
And he learned that the first time.
And he learned
that the first time.
And he acted on it.
Yeah, he certainly did. He's acting like crazy. Can't believe it's only 6 months. Couple more minutes with Dr. Oz on the 60th birthday of Medicare and Medicaid. Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Few more minutes with Dr. Oz, who's got this new job as Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator. And even though you've had these great jobs, you just said this is your favorite because certainly the most rewarding, make the greatest impact. But what is it like? Because I watched RFK, the HHS secretary, and he said, I'm with my friends. These are the people I go on vacation with. So we talk about Macquarie and Dr. Oz and you. What is it like in there? I mean, is there a sense of camaraderie?
So Bobby has called us publicly renegades because Marty McCary, who's running FDA, Jay Bhattacharya, who's running NIH, myself, it's CMS, and Bobby, of course, is our boss running, he's Secretary of Health and Human Services. We are like a band of brothers. We've been through a lot. Every one of us got canceled during COVID for different reasons, and we're vindicated and are now back trying to make the system work better that was so erroneously making decisions during COVID. But it's been decades of errors that have culminated in some of the challenges that we're facing. And I think Secretary Kennedy, Bobby, sets a very good example. We do vacation together, spend a ton of time working out issues, which is very different from what has happened in past administrations where people literally were at each other's throats. Think about this. If I can't open the Medicare database or Medicaid database so that the NIH can study pathology that's hurting the American people, so that the FDA can make better solutions to deal with those problems, and the secretary isn't talking to anybody, that's not a system. What President Trump, and he sets the standard, he wants silos broken. Watch how many times cabinet members, by the way, we mostly know each other and have known each other for a while, but most of us went through hell over the last couple of years. And so when you come together and you have an opportunity, you are mission focused and you don't waste time, but you also aren't going to create fictitious barriers. I was with Kash Patel on the 4th of July during the bill signing. And he's very quick to say, listen, if there are things we can do together, sometimes you actually need the FBI involved to take out fraudsters. Because if you've got, you know, important...
Like you just mentioned.
Like I just mentioned, the $15 billion takedown was only happened because Department of Justice got involved and all their allies together with all of our allies. Otherwise, I'm doing my little thing with the Office of the Inspector General. They're doing their little thing with subpoenas and no one's talking. We work together. We send a chilling effect, especially to foreign countries because they're weaponizing this.
So I know when it comes to nutrition, you're wide open. I watch your shows and you probably have knowledge you don't even realize that you've retained from the years hosting with different insights. But when I looked at Dr. Cassie, a traditional doctor, and he was worried about RFK, not a doctor, and some of his beliefs on vaccines, this is your friend. But are there certain things that you as a medical doctor are not comfortable with that RFK has said or done when it comes to vaccines?
Well, 10 years ago, I had Bobby Kennedy on my show to talk about vaccines. And at the time, there was a lot of criticism about me hosting him, giving him a platform to talk about his message, right? Which is the classic argument. I mean, it's the whole point of having the show, right, is to be a honey badger, right?
Yeah.
Honey badger don't care to tell the truth. So he came on and he said, please read the first line of the book. This is while I'm trying to figure out whether to overcome the resistance. First line of the book is, I'm not against vaccines. He said, read the last line of the book. Put to the last page, I'm not against vaccines. What Bobby Kennedy is saying is very straightforward. If you truly love the people around you, like a parent to their children, wouldn't you kick the tires, double check the work, just to make sure, just because you care? He's not saying these things don't work. He's saying if you are worried about fluoride in water or toxins in the environment or red dye number two, I'm going to kick the tires.
Right, and he's doing it with nutrition, doing it with vaccines, doing it with everything. Dr. Oz, great to see you. It better be quicker than last time. It's been too long.
I will come here whenever you want. I love your work. I love everything that you're – all the noises you make are fun to hear.
Thank you.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Welcome. We're at 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. I appreciate everyone being there. And, of course, got new great news last week, number 3 on the Talkers ranking for this talk show. Thanks to all you guys listening and making an impact, and we're making a lot of news. And that's what we're going to be doing this hour. The chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Congressman Jason Smith. You probably don't hear much about him, but you should. He's the one who does the dollars and cents that made the big, beautiful bill, which is now a law, come true. He's also balancing the books on everything. The president needs money. He's got to get it. He's got to make sense of it. Miranda Devine's going to be with us in a matter of moments. She has New York Post author, but she's now a extremely successful podcaster. And she just had a great sit down with Susie Wiles. And of course, we're following the president's about to make a big decisions. And we're going to go into what Joe Biden has given a 10-minute interview to the New York Times about what he did and didn't do at the end of his term. We'll get into that. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
So this whole idea that there's going to be a schism in MAGA, it's like it's the ongoing fever dream of the left, that there's going to be a schism. The idea that the Epstein thing is going to create a schism in MAGA is a little bit rich.
Yeah, Mark Thiessen, MAGA versus MAGA meltdown over Epstein files soap opera reaches new heights. Will Dan Bongino resign? Will Kash Patel follow him out the door? Is Pam Bondi safe? And can the president de-escalate the family fight? Why it all matters for the base.
Number two.
But I am very disappointed with President Putin. And I thought he was somebody that meant what he said. And he'll talk so beautifully and then he'll bomb people at night. We don't like that.
Major announcement on U.S. policy towards Russia today, as the president seems to have reached his threshold for being lied to by Vladimir Putin. Why I think adopting the Senate's bipartisan sanctions, along with unfreezing the money and giving it to Ukraine, could be the difference in the president's finest foreign policy hour.
Number one.
Because, you know, you have people who don't want to leave their homes, who are not going to work. And they are in need of cash. We're organizing food deliveries.
Yep, that is Mayor Karen Bass, an embarrassment to the country. The left melting down over ICE as one judge looks to limit their West Coast action. We have all aspects of immigration, the immigration fight, including Tom Holman almost got into a physical fight. And what Karen Bass, by the way, was just referring to was the fact that she has come up with this stupid idea, a state that's over $1 billion in the red. She is going to be giving cash to illegal immigrants who are too afraid to work illegally because they're afraid they're going to be scooped up. Think about that for a second. How backwards California is. Miranda Devine joined us now. Miranda, can you wrap your head around this mayoral decision?
Well, no. I mean, it's just so lawless, and it's basically sabotaging her own people. So I don't understand it, but it's just part of the Democrat craziness.
It is. And when it comes to immigration, I think they're back in the courts today because they wanted to limit what ICE could do on the West Coast. So they're obviously appealing that. So I want to talk about the family fight that's happening over the Epstein files. First off, why do you think it's such a big deal to the MAGA world?
Look, I think that an appetite was created. It's, you know, an amazing story just on its face, just if you're talking about narratives, it has everything. And Epstein, you know, the mysterious circumstances of his death has just turbocharged the excitement. And, you know, there's still a mystery over whether he committed suicide or did someone from the deep state murder him or, you know, was he blackmailing people? And then you add into the mix anything to do with pedophilia just makes people crazy. And, you know, Epstein, beyond a shadow of a doubt, did abuse these young girls that he was luring into sort of prostitution, basically. And so I think that heady mix, and then there were many MAGA people who were stirring the pot and implying that they had secret knowledge that no one else had, and that, you know, when Trump got in, all of this secret knowledge would be exposed. But I think they were over-egging the pudding. And a perfect example of that is really Pam Bondi when she said she had the Epstein client list on her
desk. I want people to hear that. Now, Here it is. Cut 24.
I was asked a question about the client list, and my response was,
the DOJ may be releasing the list of Jeffrey Epstein's clients? Will that really happen?
It's sitting on my desk right now to review. That's been a directive by President Trump.
And then she said this last week, cut 24.
I was asked a question about the client list, and my response was, it's sitting on my desk to be reviewed, meaning the file along with the JFK, MLK files as well. That's what I meant by that.
No, people didn't like that explanation, I guess.
Well, no, it wasn't a very good explanation because her answer to John Roberts on Fox was pretty clear. The client list was the question, and that was what she said was sitting on her desk. I think that she was just, she hadn't taken the time. She didn't know what was sitting on her desk. She assumed and believed all the stuff that had been said about client lists and everything beforehand. And I guess, you know, that stuff just didn't exist. That's the way I feel. I don't think it's some nefarious plot that now Pam Bondi and Cash Patel and Dan Bongino are in to cover up. I just think that if there ever was that material in the FBI vaults, that it's certainly not there now. Whether it ever existed or was scrubbed, I don't know. But there was ample opportunity for it to be scrubbed during the Biden administration. And maybe it was never there, because if, as some are suggesting, Epstein was an intelligence asset, then there wouldn't necessarily be material there. And I noted that John Ratcliffe, the CIA director were sitting quietly at the other end of the table when Pam Bondi was being cross-examined the other day by the media. And, you know, he probably knows more. He was writing furiously in a notebook as Donald Trump and Pam Bondi were answering those questions. So, look, to me, I think the person who knows everything about Epstein and who the other abusers were is Ghislaine Maxwell. She's in jail. She should spill the beans, and she could be offered a deal of some sort to pressure her into exposing who the other people were. You know, that's to me the most fruitful path, rather than, you know, flogging a dead horse, trying to find so-called files that maybe never existed in the first place.
So this is what struck me. Dan Bongino came to our show, Fox and Friends. So did Kesh Patel, went to Maria's show, Cut 25.
But the problem is there's been like 15 years of people coming in and creating fictions about this that doesn't exist. Where's the videotape of an Epstein Island of X, Y, and Z committing these frauds? Why haven't you given it to us? Do you really think I wouldn't give that to you if it existed? I'm working my ass off along with the leadership at the Bureau and DOJ to get you what we're allowed to give you.
And then Dan Bongino said this on Fox and Friends, Cut 26.
I just want to be crystal clear on this. I am not asking anyone to believe me. I'm telling you what's there and what isn't.
Right.
There is nothing in the file at this point on the Epstein case. And there's going to be a disclosure on this coming shortly. We are working through some. There is video. That is something the public does
not. There's video of him killing himself.
No, no, not the actual act. But there, the entire MCC Bay, it was only one camera. There were other. There's video that when you look at the video, and we will release, that's what's taken a while on this. We are working on cleaning it up to make sure you have an enhanced, right. And we're going to give the original so you don't think there were any shenanigans. You're going to see there's no one there but him.
And he said he went on to say he killed himself. But the problem is I guess a minute or two gone on the tape. They said that's when they re-racks. And now people go, aha, that 2 minutes is the story.
I mean, that was the most monumental blunder. It has just poured gasoline on the fire. I cannot believe that the FBI released that video without going through it themselves and finding that 1 minute that the internet sleuths discovered immediately. What a blunder. You know, Pam Bondi's blundered, and now Bongino or whoever released that videotape has blundered. But these blunders are pretty minuscule. They're not that important, and they certainly, in my mind, do not justify these increasingly frenetic calls for Pam Bondi to be fired, because that's issuing an ultimatum to Donald Trump, who doesn't take kindly to ultimatums, no matter who they're from. And he has a no-scalp policy. He didn't get rid of Pete Hegseth when everyone was calling for his blood after Signalgate. He's not going to get rid of Pam Bondi. He just issued a Truth Social on the weekend saying, leave Pam Bondi alone. She's doing a great job. So I don't understand this sort of self-immolating instinct among some people on the conservative side of politics to just throw their own people overboard at the first mistake. I mean, everyone is going to make mistakes, and there's a lot of pressure on these people. I give them grace.
Of course, plus it's not the Ukraine-Russia war where people are going to live it. This is done. This is a terrible person.
Exactly.
I tell you the truth, Miranda, I'm not one of these people that thinks that everyone's lying to me. I don't think 9/11 was an inside job. I do think we landed on the moon. So, exactly. I mean, I am not. And if I did believe that Lee Harvey Oswald had a bunch of people working for him and they all worked together, and then you showed me the facts, I'd go, okay. I think there's a lot of people that don't want the blunders aside. There's a lot of people that don't want to know that he killed himself and there might not be a list. That would disappoint people. If the facts disappoint you, it's not the facts' fault.
That's very true. And look, I think people are now looking at politics as entertainment, and politics includes these kind of big mysteries. And the overarching narrative is that the deep state, which I I agree is terrible. Look what they how they sabotaged Donald Trump. But that there's somehow, you know, pedophile rings and they're all connected with this one world government, et cetera. And I think that's just taking it too far. There's no real evidence for that. And I think people need to get their feet back on the ground. And I also think that the influencers out there who fan the flames and continue on with the conspiracies and encourage them are doing the wrong thing. I know it gets clicks, makes money, but it's just leading good people down the garden path and it's hurting the country.
So one of the theories is that Jeffrey Epstein worked for the Mossad and they basically have pictures of all these people and everybody who works for the Mossad. So that was said over the weekend again. And Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister, put this on Twitter, I guess an hour ago. As a former prime minister with the Mossad reporting directly to me, I say to you 100% certainty, the accusation that Jeffrey Epstein somehow worked for Israel or the Mossad running a blackmail ring is categorically and totally false. And
wow.
And just came out. And so and he goes on to say, okay, the accusation is a lie being peddled by prominent online personalities such as Tucker Carlson, pretending that they know things they don't. They just make things up, say it with confidence, and these lies stick because it's Israel. There's a vicious wave of slander and lies against my country and my people, and we just won't take it anymore. Pretty big, right?
Very interesting. Yeah, that is big. I mean, look, it's not going to satisfy people because they'll say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? So, and look, the reason that there's this idea that Epstein was owned by the intelligence, whether foreign or American, is because Alex Acosta, the former U.S. attorney in Florida who gave him that sweetheart plea deal back in 2008, kind of left the question on the table. There was a British journalist for the Daily Beast, which is not a reputable organ, wrote a story way back saying that Alex Acosta had told the Trump transition folk in 2016 that he'd been warned off Epstein, go easy on the case, because Epstein was part of the intelligence, right? He was an intelligence asset. Well, Alex Acosta has been asked about that at a press conference back in 2019, and he didn't outright say it was not true. He didn't outright say it was true. What he said was, oh, you know, there's doubt in these things and people chasing rabbit holes, etc. My feeling is that it served him to cast a bit of doubt over it because he had been in charge of the sweetheart plea deal, which was very controversial, and everyone was angry about, and he was trying to take the heat off him, maybe. Or maybe Epstein is, you know, was an intelligence asset. I don't know. But we're never going to find out because this is intelligence. We, you know, if he was a CIA guy, we're never going to find out. So what's the point? You know, to me, it's not the biggest mystery. And I think there are worse things that we need, if we're going to look in the rearview vision mirror, to get to the bottom of, like the Russia collusion hoax, which Chuck Grassley's doing a good job with, that we need to stop because we want to prevent the deep state coming after Donald Trump now and any other Republican in the future.
I hear you. And you did write about how most people, most Democrats, 69% still believe the Russia hoax and that Trump was involved with that. So, and that's one of your columns out now. And how do we get your podcast, Miranda?
It's on YouTube and Apple and Amazon and wherever podcasts are. And it's called Pod Force One. And the latest episode is Susie Wiles.
Yep, I watched it. It's great. Miranda Devine, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
You got it. 1-866, thank you, Miranda Devine. Bottom of the hour, Congressman, the chairman of the Ways and Means, Jason Smith. You listen to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Yeah, we're just waiting to find out what the details are on Ukraine. And you know how fervently I am for, and it's been tough when the president starts saying that Zelensky and who knows who started the war and Zelensky's annoying and all with the meltdown. the whole time is Zelensky's a guy in under battle, under siege for over 2 years. So if he was a little short-tempered that day, I hope it didn't jeopardize relations. To the president's immense credit, it didn't. It ruined that day for sure. But now in the way Russia's been acting, they think they can outright win. And the president has a huge problem when he goes over and tries to reason and give this guy an off-ramp, and he knows he's lost 1 million people, some casualties just off the battlefield, and a lot of deaths. Here's what he said yesterday about what could be coming down any minute today, Cut 11.
We're going to see what we will see tomorrow, okay? We have the Secretary General. As you know, Europe has announced sanctions, but I am very disappointed with President Putin. You know, I thought he was somebody that meant what he said, and he'll talk so beautifully, and then he'll bomb people at night. We don't like that.
But he's not bombing soldiers. What's getting to the president is they're going after apartment buildings. They have these drones that hunt people, and they're hunting down children. And this is in stark detail. I mean, it's not according to a report. No, this is what's happening. They know how to find people, and they're going for kids, let alone the ones they kidnapped. Flat out of the, just away from, just taking them out of these cities. So they were going to be able to keep what they took. You know, no one's saying that, but the 20% of the Ukraine, they were just going to keep it. And the president would say, enough, let's just stop the war and we'll end it here. We're going to figure out what's going to be the tripwire to make sure it doesn't happen again. And he won't even hear of it because he thinks he can win because they're building their own production, the artillery at a crazy rate. But now, according to reports, Zelensky has said that he has gotten, Germany has agreed to buy 2 Patriot missile batteries from us and giving it to Ukraine. NATO's general secretary will be buying weapons from us and giving it to Ukraine. So there's a lot of hope there. I'll tell you what, Ukrainians have earned it. You see how they fight? See how determined they are to survive?
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The work requirements are a ruse. What they're doing is they're doubling the paperwork on everyone, not just able-bodied adults, but everyone. What they're hoping is, sadly, that parents with a special needs child who are really busy don't check a box.
It doesn't surprise me that the Trump's crew are trying to change the subject as quickly as possible. But we're talking about 14 million Americans being thrown completely off of their Medicaid coverage.
So that is just some Democrats describing the law that is signed into law July 4th, the big, beautiful law now by the president of the United States. And they talk about Medicaid and the cuts and people will die. I told you, Larry Summers in his column in New York Times says 100,000 people will die. Where he came up with that number, I have no idea. But the chairman of the Ways and Means, Jason Smith, has been working on this arguably harder than anybody else and more responsibly on his shoulders to make the math add up. He joins us now. Chairman, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Brian.
First off, do you want to respond to those accusations from 3 Democrats?
I absolutely will. Listening to those, it is an absolute bogus distortion of what this bill does. This number that they throw out of 14 million people, 14 million Americans thrown off health care. Let's break down that 14 million, Brian. 4.8 million of those people are able-bodied, healthy adults who just choose not to work. It is their choice. They choose not to work. There's 1.4 million in that number that are illegals that should not have ever been receiving it to begin with. And then there's 1.6 million people who can be on other forms of subsidized health care rather than that. And then simply there's 1.3 million that are just already ineligible for Medicaid, but they're currently on it. Then under Obamacare, there's 1.8 million that are illegals that's currently on the program that's being taken away. And then 1.1 million, Brian, are fraudsters who don't submit the common sense verification requirements. And when you hear like the governor of Kentucky saying that this is doubling the paperwork, what that means, Brian, is right now, before the One Big Beautiful Bill, that you just had to get verification one time a year and say that you would lose eligibility in 7 days, you still would get to keep it for the next 51 weeks in the year. This just requires re-verification every 6 months. That's what they're talking about, doubling the paperwork.
So I listened to Dana Bash say, I thought Republicans were against red tape. I'm like, what are you talking about? They're just trying to stop fraud. What is...
Brian, we're just trying to make sure that these safety net programs like Medicaid and Medicare, that they are there for the people who need it and the people who are not abusing it. These programs were not made for illegal immigrants. They were not made for fraudsters. They were not made for able-bodied, healthy adults with children who wants to spend 6 hours a day playing video games rather than having a productive work life. These work requirements that's in this bill, Brian, are 80 hours a month. And that's 20 hours a week. And that can be volunteer work. You just have to be productive and you have to be an able-bodied, healthy adult. This is an 80% issue that Americans support this. You would think the Democrats would try to support it, but their distortions are unreal.
So I want you to hear, here's Tom Tillis, a Republican, cut 41.
I'm telling the president that you have been misinformed. You supporting the Senate mark will hurt people who are eligible and qualified for Medicaid.
So, and he went on as a wild rant. Are you hiding something from the president? Who's right here?
Yeah, I would strongly disagree with Mr. Tillis. I disagreed with him, too, when he voted against my bipartisan tax package in the last Congress. So he hasn't voted for a tax cut yet since I've been up here in the last couple years. But what I will say is that description saying that people are going to be thrown off of Medicaid is ridiculous. And they're saying that because of the able-bodied healthy adults that's not going to be insured under Medicaid because they're choosing not to work when they show up at a healthcare facility or a hospital in a rural part of the state, they're not compensated apparently because they're not on Medicaid. That is what they're trying to stretch out, saying that it's going to lead to hospital closures, it's going to lead to, yeah, to more people being thrown off, which is just a bogus math. These are people that should have never been on the program.
So I want you to hear the former Clinton Treasury Secretary, cut 42.
Just to start with, what your people have been describing is the biggest cut in the American safety net in history. The Yale Budget Lab estimates that it will kill over 10 years 100,000 people. That is 2,000 days of death like we've seen in Texas this weekend. In my 70 years, I've never been as embarrassed for my country on July 4th.
Your thoughts?
That kind of reasoning is exactly why the Democrats are out of touch with mainstream America, because that's basically saying unless you're provided complete government assistance that you're going to end up in debt if you don't receive it. That's just not how it operates. The average everyday American who's working hard to provide for their family and put food on their table and clothes on their backs, they don't like the fact that people are beating the system and they're out for a free ride.
So I don't get it. Josh Hawley says, how dare you cut Medicaid? And other people say, how dare you not cut more? So you're in many ways, you're in a tough, really tough situation because Medicaid is getting bigger than Medicare. And Medicare also needs to be addressed, let alone Social Security, which I think has till 2030 to fix its numbers, right?
Exactly. But it goes back to everything. Who disagrees with a work requirement for an able-bodied, healthy adult who's on Medicaid? That is the main impact in these Medicaid reforms. And who does not think that if you're healthy, if you're able-bodied, you're an adult, you don't have a disability, and you have zero children, why should you not have to work in order to just keep your health care at least 20 hours a week? This is what every Brian, you have to work in order to get your health care. I have to work in order to get mine. So, yep. Like, if I wasn't a member of Congress, I wouldn't have health care. I know some people believe that once you're a member of Congress, you have health care for life, which is simply not true. But, you know, we still have to pay for it.
So I want you to hear Larry Summers went on, you know, and he is not a left wing guy. You know, he was very critical of the rescue plan and inflation. He predicted it under Joe Biden, you know, as a Democrat. So
I quoted him a lot.
Yeah,
I agree.
So listen to this.
These higher interest rates, these cutbacks in subsidies to electricity, these reductions in the availability of housing, the fact that hospitals are going to have to take care of these people and pass on the costs to everybody else, and that's going to mean more inflation, more risk that the Fed has to raise interest rates and run the risk of recession, more stagflation. That's the risk facing every middle-class family in our country because of this bill.
So, I mean, he's incensed by it. Obviously, do you want to take on that math?
I would just say that if we have a growth rate, Brian, of just 2.8% over the next 10 years, which if you look at the 50-year average, it's been 2.7%. CBO is projecting a 1.8%, which I think is completely wrong and inaccurate. But if we have a 2.8%, this bill that we just passed, even by CBO's math, would be cutting $500 billion from the deficit. And when people are talking about high interest rates and economic uncertainty, it's because of all the government spending and increasing the national debt. This bill, just with a 2.8% growth rate, which is very reasonable, it's right at the 50-year average, would actually cut the deficit at $500 billion, plus people would have lower tax rates.
Yeah, I mean, I know that you're not like the president. The president is extremely frustrated at the current interest rate right now. Can you make a financial argument that they should be cut?
Absolutely. Look at the inflation numbers. The only reason why the interest rates was increased is because of the Democrats' uncontrollable spending that caused inflation to rise over 20% in the last 4 years. And we now have hit record low inflation in the last 4 years. So inflation is literally non-existent. And so those interest rates needs to go down. That right there alone is the simple reason of why the president's exactly right. They should be lowering the interest rates.
Yeah, and we'll see if he has a chance to do that, because I know the president's trying to just figure out a legal way to make a change. When you look at what's happening now with the tariffs and some of the rates, have you been clued in to what they're working on with Kevin Hassett and Lutnick and Bessent?
I have, and I've been working with Ambassador Jamison Greer as well. And the president is on the verge of releasing some really good trade negotiations with other countries. There's over 75 different countries, Brian, that have reached out to the administration saying that they want to come to the table. And we saw the most recent one, the United Kingdom agreement. It opened up ag into the United Kingdom, which has been blocked for such a long time. This is great for our farmers. And this is the whole purpose of it. We need to make sure that whether it's tariffs or non-tariff barriers, that the American farmer, the American manufacturer, the American workers treated fairly on the world stage. And these people's coming to the table, and I think you're going to see some announcements very soon.
So right now, in terms of flat out, in other words, I get the sense that Germany is pressing the EU to do a deal. And I think that India is extremely close. And I imagine that Japan can be too far behind, although they're digging in on cars. You would know better than me, but right now, revenue from tariffs in June increased 301% in a year. The U.S. brought in $27 billion in just last month, and overall, $113 billion. Where does that money go?
Well, just look at last month, and no one's talking about this, Brian, but last month, we actually had a budget surplus of $26 billion for the month of June. This is the first time that we've had a monthly budget surplus since 2016, since June of 2016, so 9 years ago. And the reasoning for that is, of course, high tax receipts that came in the month of June, but also high tariffs that came in the month of June. So the first month in 9 years, we had a surplus, not a deficit, a surplus. No one's talking about that. That's a step in the right direction.
What about a rescission package? I understand $9 billion is on the table that Doge recommended. Now you're going to look to make it official. Some of the things that are in the $9 billion, where are we at? Did you hand it to the Senate?
The House passed the $9 billion rescissions package, which isn't a lot, but it is something, and it's what the White House asked for. The Senate has been negotiating it right now. Hopefully, they'll be able to get the votes to pass it. It was tough to get the votes out of the House. Whenever you start cutting people's projects, people want to cut spending until it's stuff that they care about. But this is, I believe, wasteful spending whenever you're looking at what we're cutting in the $9 billion.
Yeah, let's see if they can start doing that, and then it'll get a bit of a run, and then see where we go as we begin to cut and get into that mindset. What do you think changed? Just before I let you go, there's so much in this bill. A lot of people think it should have been two or three bills, but you got it all done in once. When do you think we're going to feel the impact?
We're going to fill it immediately. A lot of the tax provisions that we had in this bill are taking effect of January 1st of this year. So when people file their taxes next spring, they're going to see the benefit.
Wow. I think I just
lost it. Every American on average would have seen a tax increase of 21% to 22%. This bill right here, on average for a family that makes less than $100,000 gets an additional 12% tax cut. So you're looking at the enhanced child tax credit. You're looking at the enhanced standard deduction. No tax on tips, no tax on overtime, tax relief for seniors. These are all things that whenever people file their taxes next spring, they're going to see the immediate impact. And all the businesses, whenever they see the 100% expense or the interest deductibility favorable calculation, those are all things that's helping these businesses grow and invest now because they have certainty in their tax code.
All right, Chairman. And by the way, the conservatives are looking for two more tax cuts. What else can you do before the midterms?
So we got a lot on our plate. Right now, trade is definitely front and center. It's a big priority of the president. It's also over the Ways and Means Committee, which I'm chair of. And so we're definitely diving into trade. But
okay,
there's some bipartisan tax stuff that we can also do towards the end of the year.
That'll be great. And let's see if we can get some trade deals done, because I know the market would love that. Chairman Jason Smith, thanks so much.
Great to be with you, Brian.
All right, back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
What do you think it is about you, Rosie, that so gets under his skin that, 19 years later, he's still getting up and sending those messages about you yesterday? What is it about you?
Well, I think it's because we grew up in the same area. Now, I'm 63. He's like 107 or something. I don't know. Like, he's in his late, he's 80, right? So it's a 17-year difference. And I think I remind him of all the kids at school who never liked him. This was, you know, I'm a tough New York tomboy girl. And I think that his crap never flew with me or with New Yorkers. And if you grew up in New York at the same time I did, and he was in the periphery of your life, you would know what every New Yorker knows, is that he's a joke. He's a con man and he's a criminal. And nobody was fooled in New York by him. Nobody. And when he ran for office, it was such a joke. Like, I was certain that he would never win.
So everything he said, she blew up her own argument. If you grew up in New York, you knew it was a joke. Well, no one thought that. If you grew up in New York, you knew it was a joke. They chose him to host The Apprentice. For 5 years, it was the number one show. If you were in New York, you knew he was a joke. Or in America, you knew he was a joke. He won 2 of 3 times. And the second time, he got more votes than the first time, even after the pandemic, almost getting in and almost dying. So what is she talking about? So is she insulting everyone that voted for him? And I don't think, by the way, I grew up on Long Island. There's no way I see eye to eye with Queens. There were people that left Queens and went to Long Island to get away from it. Very few people move into Queens unless you got to be close to the city. But there's no way we see eye to eye with people from Queens or Manhattan. You have no idea. She has no idea what she's talking about. Trump just likes taking shots at her because it's fun. And she looks so pathetic sitting there in Ireland all by herself, looking worse every day. And he says, why don't I just talk about the big win I had over the once big star?
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where we might be 6 months away from electing a socialist, an incompetent, unaccomplished socialist who might be a communist, certainly a Marxist, but I digress. Coming up, we are going to be speaking this hour to Stephen Moore. He's a former chief of staff of the House and House Representatives and founder of the Ukraine Freedom Project. Big news coming on that front. And Anna Shevetsky, the chief operating officer of the Ukrainian Freedom Project, will be joining us too. Both be in studio here domestically, but eyes on what's happening over in Kyiv. Man, they're constantly under attack. With me in studio is Congressman Jody Arrington, House Budget Committee Chairman, fresh off the passing of the big, beautiful bill turn law. And we should talk about, I mean, your position right now, you have one of the hardest jobs. I talked to Jason Smith earlier, tough one, Ways and Means.
Yes.
But so were you. When you looked at one big, beautiful bill, there was a big pushback in the Senate side, do it too. And then the Speaker said, no way. We got to do it at one. I got too many diverse opinions and approaches and objectives where if I can't tell them, go with me here and I'll give you this, I can't do it. So you went with one. You did it.
Well, he was right. We needed all the carrots, defense, border, tax cuts, fiscal reforms, which I'm a big fan of, given that my seat as budget chairman and this unsustainable debt trajectory our country's on. They all had to come in play. We had the smallest majority in the House in 100 years. We could only lose one vote. We lost Thomas Massie's vote. You couldn't lose any votes beyond that to get the resolution, which unlocked the process. Look, at the end of the day, it wasn't going to be perfect. It's sort of the Reagan 80-20 record tax and spending cuts, record energy deregulation, record and generational welfare reform. All in all, our country's safer, stronger, more prosperous as a result.
What was the challenge with undoing the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really the New Green Deal? What was the challenge with unwinding some of that? Why wasn't it easier?
Well, there, like a lot of issues, you have single-member district interest that come into play. There are some members who have a lot of wind and solar and other renewables. And so there was,
if you're not subsidizing that all of a sudden.
And yeah, absolutely. So there was that. The bigger picture, I think, was that these were distortive. These were regressive. These were causing inflationary energy prices for working families. The president was against it. I was in the first meeting with him, with just the House guys, when we were working on the resolution, the fiscal framework that unlocked it all. And he was clear he wanted it all gone. But we had to work through that. There was the other issue was there were projects that were underway. They'd either commenced construction or they'd raised money. And there were a lot of folks that said, hey, let's change the policies, but let's not pull the rug out from folks who depended on
them. You
got
workers.
And I think that's fair. And I think we struck the right balance. Look, what we did to repeal or wind down not only the tax credits but also the projects – saves $500+ billion of about a $700 billion tax subsidy. So I think we did Well, I think we leaned in on the conservative side on that, got some other fiscal reforms in Medicaid, SNAP, altogether record $1.5 trillion in spending cuts. That's twice as much as we've ever cut in the history of the country.
And I know the Republicans believe that if you can grow at over 2.5%, that you're not going to add to the deficit. And CBO says you're going to grow at 1.7%.
Boy, you're good, Brian. That's not many people can keep up with all these numbers, but that's absolutely correct. The CBO has the same basically annual average GDP or growth rate assumption that they had under Biden's policies, failed economic policies, tax, spend, regulate, and their, you know, horrible unbridled spending that caused 40-year high inflation. Their estimate was basically the same as under the last 4 years in those failed policies. We know for a fact, not having the model, just best way to predict the future is past performance. Trump had a 2.8 GDP rate prior to COVID and was on the rise. Mm-hmm. Record corporate revenue from the tax cuts, more capital, repatriation of capital overseas, record R&D investment, lowest poverty rate in recorded history. All these things were happening because of the Trump tax cuts and deregulation and other Republican policies. We picked a 2.6 annual average rate. We were conservative because I wanted the gravy above that, which I knew we would be able to achieve, to go to deficit reduction. So that is the big gap. You're right, between what CBO says is going to be adding trillions of dollars in new debt to what I believe will not just be a balanced resolution process or offset the deficits, but I think we're going to see the debt and deficit to GDP come down over the 4 years, and we haven't even seen the savings and discretionary spending that's up next. And we already got record revenue from tariffs. Another conversation altogether on the policy, which I'm for.
Are you in on those deals?
Absolutely.
By the way? Okay.
I'm on the trade subcommittee, and any self-respecting sovereign nation would not tolerate the unfairness with which our companies, manufacturers, producers, and workers are treated. It's gone on too long, and there's a real problem economically, but also supply chain dependence and national security implications. Mm. We saw it with COVID. We have to address it. Trump's got the will to do it. No one else has. It's been decades of unfair practices that have to stop.
And you saw what Senator Tom Tillis said. He said, well, basically, Obamacare, the president, when they passed Obamacare, Obama lost 63 seats in the House. He said, stop this. Don't pass this bill, Mr. President. I'm telling you, you're getting bad information. Here's a little of what he said. Cut 41.
I'm telling the president that you have been misinformed. You supporting the Senate mark will hurt people who are eligible and qualified for Medicaid.
And he went on for about a half hour and then said, I'm not going to run again. So he's from your party. What is he missing?
He's missing the facts. The facts are at least 80% of our voters across the party lines want us to steward their tax dollars and prevent people ineligible, illegal, receiving benefits, and otherwise hurting the sustainability of these important safety nets for the vulnerable American citizens who depend on them. They also support able-bodied adults working when they're receiving social services. It's part of the social compact. And we've trapped people in poverty and dependence on the federal government for too long. So he's missing it. Obamacare failed. Prices went up. We lost choice. It was a failed experiment.
Didn't he expand Medicaid?
He expanded Medicaid with a 90% match for healthy, able-bodied adults and about a 60% match on pregnant, disabled, blind, elderly. That's the immorality of this, is that expansion and that match from the federal government has oriented our entire health system around these able-bodied, healthy American citizens who could get Obamacare or some other subsidized insurance. Right now, the second-class citizens per Obamacare and Democrats who supported it unilaterally are the poorest and sickest among us. And that is a reform that we should have taken on. We didn't. We did other reforms, but we didn't take that one on. That's why I still think there's fiscal reform meat on the bone if we should go for another reconciliation.
Congressman Arrington's in studio. So, Congressman, I'm sure you know that only, for the most part, polls say only 38% of the country approve of the bill. Is that part of the reason why I had Jason Smith on today? I had Dr. Oz on Fox and Friends, and you're here now. Is it time to message?
Yeah, absolutely, because you got to separate fact from fiction, and there's certainly, you know, full bore Democrat.
Because you're proud of the facts.
Absolutely. Look, more people, especially working middle-class families, will keep more of their hard-earned money. Prices will come down. The economy will grow. Our sons and daughters in uniform will have the tools to be safe and successful in providing for the common defense. The president gets the tools and resources to secure the border. We'll stop trapping people in a cycle of dependence in these welfare programs. This thing is going to do great things for our country. Is it perfect? No. But nobody has to be ashamed, and especially these accusations that sadly Tillis is repeating of the Democrat narrative and fear-mongering that somehow people eligible or some sick, vulnerable person that needs that safety net's not going to get it. That is patently false. And by the way, the proof's in the pudding. I think our best success was getting it done early enough that by the time midterms come around, people are going to feel this in their pocketbooks, in their future, quality of life in every measure. They're going to feel it, and that's going to make all the difference.
Have you felt the difference of the border in Texas? I mean, how you're over in West Texas.
Yeah, I'm in West Texas, but every community in Texas has been deluged with criminals and crime and drugs especially. Absolutely. I had a couple of press conferences back in West Texas about the big, beautiful bill. And I had sheriffs and other local law enforcement saying this president just showing up and having the political will to enforce the laws and to prioritize defending our sovereign border has fundamentally shifted everything. But he needs resources to complete the border wall. He needs resources to do the detain and deport as opposed to catch and release.
But you got it, right?
We got it. We got every cent of what he asked for. And it's not just to lock it in for today, it's for the future.
And you may disagree with me, but I think the president has an opportunity to do something with people who've been here a long time, like rural manufacturing and meatpacking and, for example, hospitality brings that up. So if you've been here a while and there might be a system where if there's a sponsor, they sign off on you, don't give citizenship, whatever you want to call it, extended work visa, special work visa, that there's got to be a way. You just can't throw out everybody. There's a ideal. And there's a practicality to
That's right.
But among the people that are not for it, when I brought it up on the Sunday show last night, is Charlie Kirk, who I knew it, but this is what he said. Cut 10.
I'm a little bit skeptical, though, not from President Trump, but from other people that are pushing, let's just say, their immigration agenda, that it seems as if we've only compromised in one direction over the last couple of decades. We do have this addiction to migrant labor in this country. We do. And breaking an addiction can be very hard. When you break addiction to alcoholism or drug use, you can sometimes have a very difficult withdrawal period. But the voters overwhelmingly voted in November that they want mass deportations, period. And 6 months in, I don't think that Trump voters or the Trump base, they necessarily want to hear something of, I won't even use the word amnesty, but some soft accommodation.
So how do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, we could
for a guy from Texas.
Well, we could have, and a big agriculture region. We provide food security for the nation.
They say 41% of all agricultural farms have illegal immigrants.
I'm certain that's true. And what I'd tell you is you can't even have the conversation on how to fix the broken legal system so that we have a win-win for people who want a better life for their families and to support our economy and our communities. You can't have that conversation with the lawlessness and chaos that ensued for the last 4 years.
But
now that he has remedied that, and now that we've given him the resources to complete that task, I think it's absolutely time. And listen, Charlie Kirk's right about, you know, when these folks are in the shadows, it does displace American workers. It does depress wages. But when you bring them out of the shadows and you do it in a legal way, then I think everybody wins. And by the way, if we're going to have a rocket ship economy and exceed these metrics on economic output, labor is a big constraining factor.
This is the pushback. I would say, okay, I got your sponsor, been with you 16 years, right? Shows up every day. All right, you're sponsoring him. He gets insurance, right? He gets insurance.
Absolutely.
Right? He gets insurance. And he's got to have a wage that's commensurate with what they're doing in West Texas,
right? I'll go one step further. They broke the law. There has to be a consequence. So I don't – if it's the employer or the individual or some combination, there's a fine. You got to. First and foremost, rule of law, cornerstone of a civil society, we don't ignore that fact. So there's got to be some penalty and commensurate with the crime, so to speak.
See, what happened with Reagan? Reagan was told they were going to seal the border if he gave them amnesty. They never sealed the border, so he'll never trust the Democrats again. But Republicans didn't seal it either, so there was no wall built, there was no enforcement done, there was no electronic stuff that we have today. Cameras can do a lot of that work. So I go, and I saw the president yesterday, I even said, you know, if you were to do it, you did something Reagan didn't do, or you sealed the border. No one thought that was possible.
Exactly.
And now you got money to make sure and a wall to finish.
That's it. That's it. That was the missing piece. I think it was premature in the Reagan deal. I mean, like you said, he was betting on the come, and it never came from the Democrats. The president has everything he needs, tools, resources to lock it down. I think this is one that the president is so perfectly suited for. And if you look back at the Trump 1 administration, the Democrats said, we want legal status for DACA. Okay, that was their big hue and cry. And we wanted border security. He put on the floor for a vote basically the compromise bill that gave us all the border security but also dealt with legal status for DACA recipients. No one ever thought that could happen. He went sort of against what I would say are the conventional Republican norms. The Democrats peeled off. We didn't get a single vote. We had a lot of – we were very close, 25 votes. Right. This president, just like we did with USMCA and others, can negotiate a deal now, I think.
Just say what I do so too. And you're a conservative guy, so that's very interesting. But Charlie Kirk, like the MAGA crowd, is not going to want to hear it. I am not – I'm more practical. John Kerry and Bernie Sanders have something in common. You know what it is?
What's that?
They suddenly realized that we're not a country without borders. If you have borders, you should enforce the border. Democrats have not done a good job, as they should. Period. End of discussion. Almost verbatim, Bernie Sanders and John Kerry. Real quick, 20 seconds. Now all of a sudden we need a border?
It's, you know what? The left has totally captured these guys. The fact that we got resistance from, and this is another issue, on welfare reform when Bill Clinton had a stronger welfare reform than Joe Biden signed, 35 hours a week. Ours is 20 a week. I wanted to go bigger. I mean, the Democrat Party is not Bill Clinton's
party.
We could
do our own five-hour show. No. Congressman Jody Arrington, congratulations.
Thanks, Brian.
You worked, and you had to make the math work. Back in a moment. The president's got a press conference now. I'm going to tell you the latest on Ukraine.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
In a nutshell, we're going to make top-of-the-line weapons, and they'll be sent to NATO. NATO may choose to have certain of them sent to other countries where we can get a little additional speed, where the country will release something, and it'll be mostly in the form of a replacement.
So right now there's a press conference ongoing, as usual, with the President of the United States. All is out there and real, and he's having a press conference with the General Secretary of NATO, Mark Rutte. He's a good friend of our show. He'll call in, hopefully, tomorrow. You know, we're in very good standing with NATO, but the president has seen enough. He is going to be allowing NATO to buy weapons from us. And Germany, for example, said, I'm buying, Mr. President, I'm buying the chancellor, new chancellor. I love this guy. He seems fantastic. This new chancellor says, I'm going to buy these patriots from you. I'm giving them to Ukraine. And the president says, I'm letting these guys buy weapons from me and we're going to get them out. So this is, it's perfect. It's perfect. Because I just wish our military manufacturing base was greater. Because you realize how much profit we could be making. Yes, from our allies, profit. As they all commit to doing the 5%, you know, Finland and Sweden and Germany and France and England, the people that have the countries that have money, Estonia doesn't have an air force. Realize what we could be doing, building profit and maintenance contracts in with all this. But I really give credit to the President of the United States. We'll talk more about that in a moment as the details of what we're going to do to support Ukraine come forward. Russia, you had an off-ramp, you blew it, now you'll pay the price.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox, then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
He's so busy,
he'll make your head spin.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
We make the best equipment, the best missiles, the best of everything. The European nations know that. And we've made a deal today, and I'm going to have Mark speak about it, but we've made a deal today where we are going to be sending them weapons and they're going to be paying for them. We, the United States, will not be having any payment made. We're not buying it, but we will manufacture it, and they're going to be paying for it. Our last meeting of a month ago was very successful in that they agreed to 5%, which is more than $1 trillion a year, so they have a lot of money. And these are wealthy nations. They have a lot of money, and they want to do it. They feel very strongly about it, and we feel strongly about it, too. But we're in for a lot of money, and we don't want to do anymore, and we can't. But we make the best, and we're going to be sending the best to NATO, and in some cases to maybe... at Mark's suggestion, if we go to Germany, where they're going to send early on missiles, and they'll be replaced, and NATO is going to take care of it. It's going to be coordinated by NATO, and they're going to work very much with Matt Whitaker.
Matt Whitaker's, he's our NATO secretary. So the President of the United States, he's still having his press conference right now, but he's essentially saying we're sending them Patriot missiles. The NATO's buying them from us, and Germany is buying them from us. They're going to rush them in there, and if they're going to get new, they'll give them the old, because they got to get some defensive weapons in. That's what Zelensky's been asking for. We also hear they're short on artillery. Now, about the massive sanctions coming from the Senate, where 85 senators have voted for it, it looks like it's going to make its way to the president's desk as early as today. But he'll implement it in 50 days if they don't have a deal. He said four separate times, I thought I had a deal. And Putin has done the opposite, said it, and then had awesome, in a negative way, blitzes of drone attacks the next day or within hours of their conversation. With us right now, the guy who's living it, Stephen Moore, former chief of staff of the U.S. House of Representatives and founder of the Ukraine Freedom Project, who raises money to aid the Ukrainians. And great to see you, Steve.
Always great to be with you, Brian.
Better time now. I mean, yeah. The president gave an off-ramp to Vladimir Putin, who's lost about a million people, over a million people, casualties. He's not taking it. And how do you characterize the president's actions as we know him? It's unfolding, but as you know him.
Well, yeah. So President Trump came in. He had the idea that he had a relationship with Vladimir Putin where they could just work it out, right? You know, we're friends. There's a problem here. We can work it out. And it's taken him a while to figure out that the Vladimir Putin of 2020 in 2019, when he was last president, is not the Vladimir Putin of today. And Putin just wants one thing. He wants Ukraine. And then he will roll through other countries in Eastern Europe. He just wants to reunite the Soviet Union. So that's Putin's goal. And unless there's a heavy hand, unless there's something very strong against him, that's what he's going to go for.
So here's a little of what the sanctions would look like if the president decides to sign off on it. Right now he says 50 days, but here's what Senator Lindsey Graham said yesterday, cut 14.
Dick and I have got 85 co-sponsors in the United States Senate for congressional sanctions with a sledgehammer available to President Trump to go after Putin's economy and all those countries who prop up the Putin war machine. China, India, and Brazil buy oil and petroleum products and other goods from Russia. That's the money Putin uses is to prosecute the war. Mm-hmm. And this congressional package that we're looking at would give President Trump the ability to impose 500% tariff on any country that helps Russia and props up Putin's war machine. He can dial it up or down. He can go to zero to 500. He has maximum flexibility. But we're going after the people who keep Putin in business and additional sanctions on Russia itself.
Now, we hear about sanctions at the most sanctioned country, and Peskov has come out and said, keep sanctioning us. Doesn't matter. What's the reality? Are Russia feeling it? And what would these sanctions do?
Well, what a lot of people in America don't know is that the Russian economy is grinding down into a recession. And part of it's because of the sanctions, and part of it because is they've just leveraged the entire country to fund this war. And
but they made it a war economy. Doesn't that benefit them now? Now they're making weapons, so doesn't that work for them? Wouldn't it be harder for them to stop?
Yeah, well, that's the thing is that it's not, you know. So when was the last time you went home and picked up something in your house and looked at the bottom and said "Made in Russia"? You know. I never have, and that's because Russia doesn't make anything. It's a gas station with an army, and so what are they going to do? Like, if there's peace, then you know they're going to go back to making computers and televisions. Russia doesn't make computers and televisions, so it is a wartime economy. They're geared up for it, and there needs to be serious consequences for them.
Well, they, is this serious for you?
Which
Lindsey Graham just rattled off?
Oh yeah, and let me tell you, it's not. And the secondary sanctions are good because it's not. Just the sanctions. They're already pretty well sanctioned. It's the enforcement of the sanctions. And there's, you know, Russia makes money off of oil and gas primarily. And there's a shadow fleet right now of hundreds of ships that are flying under foreign flags. They've got false registrations. They got false electronic IDs. And those are the ones that are selling the oil to China and Iran. And we know where many of these are. And just cracking down on the sanctions evaders is going to be a real key thing here.
So what is it like on the ground?
We left about 10 days ago, so we were there for – and let me tell you exactly what happened. Putin was on the phone with Trump on the afternoon of July 3rd, and then he hung up the phone with President Trump, and he hit launch on 537 missiles and drones. And we saw many of them fly by my window. We live in Kyiv.
In Kyiv.
Yeah, so I can tell you exactly what an Iranian Shahed drone sounds like because they're using Iranian drones because Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea are all working together. And so the Ukrainians it's not like the Russians are doing a lot militarily because these are terror weapons. They're not hitting military targets with these missiles and drones. They are – in terms of the front, they have lost just this year enough people to fill Arrowhead Stadium three times. And for that, they've taken an area –
400 a week.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So about a quarter million losses just this year. And for that, they've taken an area of Ukraine about – 40% the size of Palm Beach County, Florida. So the president's home county, they haven't even taken that much yet. And so their
goal is to terrorize.
It's a terror
because
thing.
They're hitting apartment buildings, they're hitting homes, they're hitting hospitals.
Well, you know, just last week, the Russians are using kamikaze drones to hunt
and
civilians.
You have two of them here.
Yeah, I've got this is a Russian.
You can hold them up. Yeah,
this is a Russian kamikaze drone, and it was a battlefield trophy. A friend of mine gave it to me,
it weighs about 1 pound.
Yeah, well, I've got a Ukrainian one here too. The Ukrainians are much better built, but they're much heavier. This is, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 pounds, and this is probably a pound and a half. But they use these drones, the kind that I have here, they use them to hunt civilians. They call them a human safari. They actually killed a one-year-old infant in a village.
It will follow you.
Yeah, they hunt people with these things. One of the pastors we work with in a place called Kherson, they targeted him because he drove out of a church. And they hit him with a drone. He survived, fortunately, with his three children in the car.
So what I understand, too, what makes this really insidious, I'm kind of encouraged by the fact that Syria is no longer a bastion for Russia. So they no longer can flow the Shahed drones through Syria over. So I thought that was great. And then I find out, and tell me if I'm wrong, that they basically got the patent for the Shahed drones.
Yeah.
They don't need Iran.
Yeah.
So they can make it themselves.
Yeah. Well, and the Russians have sent about $4 billion to Iran for these drones, and they're making them in a place in southern Russia. And so there's a factory there. Now, there may be components that they have trouble reproducing and that you know, maybe the Iranians you know, have not sent them. But I got to tell you, man, you know, ever since President Trump took out Iran, there's actually been no slowdown. So I keep waiting for maybe they're going to run out of some particular part in these Shahed drones. And these things are big, man. They're about the size of this table. But they're coming at a very high rate. You know, 537 a week ago Thursday was the record number, and it's already been broken. Every attack is a record number.
I heard it was up to 700.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and you don't block them with Patriots.
No, and actually, they are relatively easy to take down. You can take them down with the machine guns. You can take them down with anti-aircraft fire.
That's a lot.
Yeah, you can take them down with electronic warfare, jam them. But there's a lot of them, man, and that's a lot of people with machine guns.
So, is there more of a feeling of optimism that America understands that we've reached our edge? Do you have a sense yet? Because Zelensky put out something very positive. They had a very good conversation.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, Ukraine is the most pro-American country I have ever been to. And I'll give you just one example of I was visiting there before the war, and I needed to go downtown. We were trying to park. My translator rolled down the window and asked someone if she could park in their parking garage. They said, no, it's full. And she said, I have Americans with me. And he's like, oh, you have Americans? Oh, okay, great. And he lifted up the
wow.
You know, yeah.
That's great.
And our support is crucial, not only on a military level, but they looked at us as the bastion of freedom, and they're fighting for their freedom like we did, in 1776.
Right. And I think the president's come around on that. I'm pretty confident. This, what Vladimir Zelensky put up 4 hours ago, I met with General Kellogg, the U.S. Special Forces envoy. We had a productive conversation. We discussed the path to peace and what we can practically do together to bring it closer. This includes strengthening Ukraine's air defense, joint production, and procurement of defensive weapons in collaboration with Europe. And, of course, sanctions against Russia, and those would help. We hope for U.S. leadership, as it is clear that Moscow will not stop unless its unreasonable ambitions are curbed through strength. I thank General Kellogg for his visit to Ukraine. I'm grateful to President Trump for the important signals of support and the positive decisions for both countries, and we deeply value the support of the American people. So,
wow, great statement. Yeah.
That's it.
Unambiguous. Yeah.
And Zelensky, if there was an election today—
Well, so
in Ukraine?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, prior to the White House Oval Office dust up, Zelensky was polling in second place. And then after that, after he got in the fight with President Trump, he's back in first place. And, it's like the Ukrainians are like, he can't do that to our president. Only we can do that to our president. So there was a
same with Canada.
Yeah.
Canada was helping. Same thing, but we understand. The other thing is, who would be the alternative? Poroshenko?
No. So all the old politicians are, not gonna happen unless things wildly change. What the people want is they respect the military because the military has kept them safe. You got to think this military has taken on the second largest military in the world, and Ukraine has sunk 40% of Russia's Black Sea Fleet.
Yeah.
And Ukraine doesn't have a navy, man. So the people of Ukraine want a military leader because that's what they respect right now.
They deserve it. They deserve our support. And I think that NATO is adding two countries, new emphasis on defense. They could sell it to their people as a practical threat for all, sadly, but that's what they needed to know, that Russia is legitimately a threat.
Yeah.
So they're no more Nord Stream 1, no more Nord Stream 2. They're going to look for natural gas to America or some other outlet. Hopefully they stay, understand what the threat that Russia is. Listen, a few more minutes with Steve Moore when we come back to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Fox News Audio presents Unsolved with James Patterson. Every crime tells a story, but some stories are left unfinished.
Somebody knows.
Real cases, real people. Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
One of the reasons that you're here today is to hear that we are very unhappy, I am, with Russia. But we'll discuss that maybe a different day. But we're very, very unhappy with them, and we're going to be doing very severe tariffs if we don't have a deal in 50 days. Tariffs at about 100%. You'd call them secondary tariffs. You know what that means. But today we're going to talk about something else. And as you know, we've spent $350 billion approximately on this war with Russia and Ukraine. And we'd like to see it end. It wasn't my war. It was Biden's war. It's not my war. I'm trying to get you out of it. And we want to see it end. And I'm disappointed in President Putin because I thought we would have had a deal 2 months ago, but it doesn't seem to get there. So based on that, we're going to be doing secondary tariffs. If we don't have a deal in 50 days, it's very simple. And they'll be at 100%. And that's the way it is. That can be more simple. It's just the way it is. I hope we don't have to do it.
I wish we weren't waiting 50 days, but at least that's on the table. The clock is ticking. President of the United States moments ago, and he's talking about Ukraine and getting 17 Patriot batteries, and then they're going to be others are going to be coming from others like Germany. With me in studio is Stephen Moore. You have a movie out. You have this great organization,
Ukrainian Freedom Project.
Yeah,
that's us.
Ukrainian Freedom Project. Tell me about A Faith Under Siege.
Well, you know, as I was doing humanitarian work in Ukraine, I kept running across Christians who had been tortured by the Russians for their faith. And what's happening is that there's 2.5 million Christians living in occupied Ukraine. And the Russians, Vladimir Putin shut down every church in occupied Ukraine that he does not control. And, you know, he has murdered 49 faith leaders, rabbis, priests, and pastors. And of that 49, 22 are evangelical Christians, which is almost half, but evangelical Christians make up about 4% of the population. So we made a movie, A Faith Under Siege, and people can go to faithundersiege.com and they can look at it and they can read about this and they can watch the movie.
Faithundersiege.com. Okay, extremely important. And are you going back?
Yeah, we're going back at the end of the month, and you know, we're not going to let a few missiles and drones stop us. And frankly, we're feeling better about going back now that President Trump has got his head in the game against Putin.
Right, and we'll just see what technology they can use in order to jam to stop some of the drones and see where they go forward. In terms of the draft, what is the theory behind not drafting 18-year-olds?
So Both Russia and Ukraine are facing a demographic crisis, and they're so interested in repopulating Ukraine that the only way that you can get out of serving the army is if you've got three children. And so and there's two things about younger people in their 20s. One, they have yet to reproduce, and statistically, and they're also driving a lot of the economy. The Ukrainian IT sector has actually grown during the war. Everyone in that country is better at math than I am. And so there's a lot of engineers, a lot of software engineers, and they're driving the economy. So that's what's going on there, is it's a strategic decision.
Strategic decision. And I'll say the president made a strategic decision today. Susan Glasser, probably one of his biggest critics on ABC yesterday, notices the change. Cut 21.
I think it's striking that again and again and again over the last few months, Putin has responded to Donald Trump by escalating the war. He has had an aerial bombardment of Ukraine and its civilian population in cities that has gotten tougher and tougher, frankly. The more that Putin was offered by Donald Trump, actually a very good deal. Donald Trump, according to reporting, gave him the chance to essentially keep the territory that he has illegally gained through this war of aggression. And Putin is saying, no, I want to go for it. I want to go bigger. And that indicates that Russia thinks that its military position is actually strengthening in this conflict, that Ukraine is struggling on a variety of fronts, including the idea that Donald Trump and the West is not really there for the long haul.
Because they are pretty, even combined with all our militaries, all countries, they are still making artillery and armament faster than us.
Yeah, and the North Koreans are about 40% of their shells at this point are made in North Korea. North Korea is sending about 30,000 more troops to Russia. Because again, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea are all working together. You know, Brian, we're in a global war right now, and the only people acting on that information is our adversaries.
Stephen Moore, thanks so much. Faith Under Siege, place to go. Faithundersiege.com. Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.